And we are back with episode 243 of The Critical Myth. I'm John, your host, and tonight we have...
Edmund from Greenville, and now I have to officially nominate both the blue dress and the red dress to be donated to the Smithsonian whenever COVID affairs ends.
This is Gary from Jacksonville, and I'm so glad to know that it's still possible to hotwire a modern vehicle with two wires. It's just incredible.
And I am Bronze Thumb, and in the spirit of this auspicious occasion, I'm going to say that I'm Team Ruby.
Yeah, okay. I've got no argument with that.
So you're a furry. Okay, no problem.
Well, the thing is that when someone brings up Ruby, and then I think of the fact that we're going to talk about Arrow, I start thinking of Katie Cassidy having played Ruby on Supernatural, and, well, you see how my brain works.
There's a logical connection there.
Absolutely. All right, well, we're obviously going to be talking about Once Upon a Time, Covert Affairs, Revolution, and Arrow. But first, before we get into that, Edmund, if you could please.
Here on The Critical Myth, we will be discussing anything and everything in these episodes, so be warned, you will be spoiled, but we have left about a week or so to make sure you've caught up before we do all that.
Yes, we have, and we are going to jump right into Once Upon a Time, and here is the promo.
New next Sunday, what if Red Riding Hood...
When it takes over me, I can't control it.
...and the wolf were one and the same.
It was the wolf! It was me!
A deadly curse.
We know who she is, we know where she's hiding.
...that can't be controlled.
She's out. They'll kill you. Isn't that what I deserve?
Okay, and Edmund, if you could.
Sure. This is Once Upon a Time, Season 2, Episode 7, Child of the Moon. A vicious killer is loose in Storybrooke, and Ruby is the prime suspect. Meanwhile, Leroy makes a discovery that could help Emma and Mary Margaret return home. And that just leaves out, like, the other third of the episode, which I will talk about now. So... yeah, I mean, this, one thing I felt with this episode is, we're having a, you know, last season, particularly like when the whole love triangle thing was going on, there tended to be a bit of an imbalance between stuff going on in Storybrooke that we didn't care so much about. And then the stuff happening back in the fairy tale kingdom that, was much more interesting. And I think this was an episode that was kind of bringing that back. Certainly the tale of, Snow and Red on the run through the forest, and being the full moon, and her having to go off on her own since she's ripped her hood.
John, stop looking up fan fiction.
Yes. And discovering, lo and behold, that yes, there is a pack of wolves who can control their transformations. Certainly at this point, we were getting sort of feeling like we were entering Twilight Land, or even being human U.S. from last season with the temptations of the twins, and then of course the not terribly surprising discovery that her mother is still alive, and was a wolf, and Granny was just keeping all that from her. That whole story, I thought did work really well, and even on the FX side, after some of the kind of really nasty, hard to look at CGI that they had at the top of the beanstalk, the wolves running through the woods, wasn't the greatest special effects I've ever seen, but certainly was done a lot better than that. So a lot of what was going on there I liked, but back in Storybrooke, this whole story of Ruby's going to be concerned, and enduring her first full moon since the curse was lifted, but the whole murder mystery procedural just felt just completely predictable, and especially with after being just sort of seen in the distance, glowering at Charming and Henry, I was going to say dear old dad, except of course part of the point is that he's not really his dad, his dear old pseudo dad showing up, kind of made the whole thing obvious of, she's going to get out. People are going to think she murdered somebody, and she's not going to, and it won't have been her. And yes, of course it's King George. Yeah, so I mean, most of what was going on in Storybrooke just left me completely cold. And even, you know, and even the whole thing of George leading the mob and, you know, and inciting them all, you know, I was thinking, you know, well, okay, is this him just sort of, you know, reverting back to, you know, the sort of blunt weapons he would use as the king? And but even that doesn't really fit, because, you know, he was actually kind of subtle with the way, you know, he was doing things back in the Enchanted Forest in terms of, you know, sterilizing Snow, and even the whole thing of, you know, before that, of, you know, getting her to, you know, to renounce him, because, you know, he knew if he just forbade it, you know, he would he wasn't going to just create, you know, a martyr situation. So it just felt he was, yeah, I mean, it was just too much was happening out of character. And especially with him having been the DA for all of those years, and Charming, I mean, being, you know, kind of completely out of his depth as the sheriff with, like, no real experience at it, you know, there was a chance for him to, you know, do a much more subtle undermining of his authority, especially since he was the one who did it and could have been the one finding the clues. And not to mention, you know, David apparently not being able to tell the difference between a wolf attack and an axe attack, but you know, that's almost a minor point given the rest of the stuff that was going on. So yeah, I mean, it's kind of a tale of two episodes, and even the thing of the, you know, finding the diamonds that make the fairy dust so they could use the hat, which of course is then destroyed at the end. You know, so, you know, all of this digging by the dwarves is, you know, has turned into a bit of a MacGuffin. But one of the, you know, the nice, you know, what I did like was the nice bit at the end where this, you know, unexpected and unusual partnership of Regina and Gold to give Henry the protective amulet. You know, it looks like it's finally giving them the means to communicate between the two sides. Because I think one thing the show needs right now is, you know, this whole separation of the main cast has gone on, you know, a little too long. And I think that's to some extent part of what's going on with the sort of mismatch between the storylines. I mean, the flashbacks, you know, I mean, obviously, you know, there's a certain sort of narrative force to those, because, you know, we know where all those are going. And it feels like they're spinning their wheels a little bit in the present day, and they need to get everybody back together and kind of get you know, enough setup, and let's start some more direct conflict going on here.
Bronson, how about you?
I think that if you're going to redo a plot line from the first season and not even do it better, it's probably not a good idea to call attention to it. Like, I'm sure that the writers thought they were being very clever by this. No, like, look, we're acknowledging the fact that we're basically doing the Is Mary Margaret a Murderer storyline from the previous season, but we're going to hang a lampshade on it. We're cool and meta and stuff. Yes! No. It's just no. It's not any better this time around, and in fact, it's sort of a little bit worse because you're drawing attention to the fact that you're repeating yourself. So yes, was not fond of that particular aspect of the episode, and despite the presence of Alan Dale, who is, you know, usually good value, I just was not impressed with the real world side of this, the Storybrooke side of this episode. The stuff with the flashbacks with Ruby and her family, I thought was a lot more interesting, and there was some genuine emotion there. And I think that the actress whose name I'm totally blanking on, who plays Ruby and Red, has, like, I thought she did a really good job. She was a good presence in the show, and I'm not just saying that because of the outfits. During the first season, and I thought she did a really good turn in her centric episode, and I think she's really stepped up a lot in this season. So I'm giving her more to do. I'm all for, like, that was a plus. But yeah, like, half this episode I just thought was a bit of an abject failure.
Gary, how about you?
I agree. The rehashing of this who killed somebody plot, so what seems so soon to me in this series, it makes me wonder how much the writers actually have left in them. Also, the point that was made about these storylines dragging on and on and on. I think people have really gotten fed up with that particular type of storyline. I'm not saying that they need an answer within a week, but when they stretch out resolutions 4, 5, 6 episodes long, it's a little too much for people to, you know, keep their attention and to keep interested. As we're saying, the breakdown now between Storybrooke and the fairy tale world is too much. People like to see the interplay of it a little bit more than we're seeing. Even the first season, when we had flashbacks, you could feel more of an impact. Then we have this whole thing as if the was it King George or whatever he's calling himself in Storybrooke. You know, okay. So first he was too many things in this episode. He was, you know, framing Ruby. He burned up the hat. He's trying to get Charming, I think, killed. It's nice to see that people remember how to mob with pitchforks and flaming torches. I'm glad they got their memories back.
There's just some skills that are universal.
I suppose so, as opposed to, say, a bat or something, or guns or something else that's actually somewhat modern, because they're supposed to have those memories too. Instead, boy, where do they get all these pitchforks anyway? But yet another weakness of this storyline. I did not like it nearly as much as I did the last episode, and mainly because, as I said, rehashing of the plot, I felt the antagonist, King George, was just doing too many bad things. It's one thing to do one of them, but he was doing at least three, and that's too much. The one interesting and possibly redeeming point of the episode for me was Henry's dreams, or maybe communication, I'm not quite sure, with Aurora. I wanted to see more of that, more so than see King George and his mob going after Ruby for the second time in the episode. So it left me really short. The Henry issue was the only thing that gives me a kernel that there might be hope for the storyline, because I was disappointed.
Yeah, I'll agree. That was a very interesting nugget in the midst of all of this other stuff. And they introduced the seeds of it in the last episode, and I like that they kind of expanded on it a bit. And it's just it's just bizarre, like the circumstance of it and why these two characters, of everyone in the show, these two characters are having cross-dimensional dreams. They've found Walter's pocket universe. That's the thing.
Well, now it's obviously just because they need to figure out something for Aurora to do.
Okay, good point. She can be the radio.
Yeah.
All right, well, I think we can probably... everything that can be said about this, I think, has been said. So what would we give this one? Edmund, how about you?
This one was hard because of the disparity, and I wind up giving it a 7 just... Because basically it's a matter of what's going on with Henry, what's going on in the flashbacks was very good, and what's going on in town was horrible. But they kind of balance each other out.
Yeah, I would say.
It was kind of between, is it a 7 or do I drop to a 6? And it's like, no, I'll keep it at a 7.
Exactly, that's kind of where I fell myself. But how about you, Gary?
You're much more generous than I would have been. I was actually hovering towards a 5. however, as I really did enjoy Ruby's backstory, and it's nice for them to give us a backstory of an existing character. We haven't had some of that in a while. We always get it of the character of the week, and we don't get development of existing characters. I had to give it a little bit better to a 6, but if half of it failed, I have a hard time going much above middle.
And how about you, Bronstam?
I was perhaps slightly less generous than you guys. I went a 6 because the bits that I did like didn't quite make up for the fact that the thrust of the episode I was just not only unengaged but actively disliked.
Yeah. Well, it still comes out as one of the lesser episodes of the season so far, so I think across the board we agree that there were some serious issues compared to some of the other episodes this season. All right, well, that being said, we can move on to what I think is going to be a much better discussion, and that would be Covert Affairs, and here's the promo.
Next Tuesday.
I've been targeted. I'm
immediate extraction.
There's just two episodes left this season, and Annie is on the run.
What's going on?
I'll be chased by Khalid's men.
As long as he's after me, I'll never feel safe.
Or will her plan for revenge?
I have to get to him before he gets to me.
Put everybody in danger.
All right, and Gary, if you could.
Yes, we're talking about Covert Affairs, Season 3, Episode 15, Quicksand. When Augie decides to take a veteran's holiday, and Joan decides to take a few days off as well, Annie turns to Eyal to track down Khalid and Asari. I really like this episode a lot. The premise to get Augie and Joan both sort of out of the office to leave Annie a little bit more isolated was not as well thought through as I thought it could have been, but I think it worked to move the story forward. Annie's still trying to tie up some of the loose ends around Khalid, and as she's going to try and find some information from his assumed dead girlfriend, she gets there, realizes it's not the girlfriend, and she's, I believe it was it Amsterdam or, no, it was Luxembourg. She was in Luxembourg, and she realizes that it wasn't the girlfriend. She realizes she's getting set up. There's a really nice short parking deck evasion drive-through scene. She calls up CIA to try and have somebody get her out of there, and the person who's manning Augie's desk is obviously incompetent because all she has to do is, oh, wait, I'll call you back. You can see Annie thinking, I'll be dead. What do you mean call me back? So she realizes once again that Annie is actually on her own. She is an experienced person who has had to deal with all sorts of crap now for the past three seasons. And she grabbed reins in her own hand and called the only other spy person she seems to be aware of in the world, who is, of course, Eyal. Thankfully, he is competent and is able, through the phone, to walk her across border lines and checkpoints and all over the phone without lifting a finger except talking to her, and gets her through to, where was he?
Zurich, I believe.
Zurich, yeah, Zurich. And then she goes through that. She realizes she's been, you know, set up on this plan, and they start to make plans to track down Khalid, or more specifically, his money, because we managed to freeze all of his assets after the last debacle that happened with him. And so they set up a plan where they can go and sort of get in touch with his father, who they believe is funding him, which it turns out, as best we can tell, it is. Eyal sets up this plan with tracers so that they can follow everything. However, when they get there, Annie runs into the actual real girlfriend and tries to talk her out of staying with Khalid, saying she's going to end up dead. Sure enough, not five more minutes into the scene, killed right next to the car that she was leaving in. So Annie could only say she was right. However, Annie's doing it in a much more heartless way than I've ever seen the character do it before. There's a real detachment to it that I guess the last season or so has sort of taken some of the Annie that we've known earlier on and gotten rid of her, honestly. She seems a little bit more cold and calculating. Anyway, so she goes back with Eyal, and turns out somehow Khalid's father's people found out where they were. So, I mean, it's a cute little scene in some sense, although I have points that I'll make about it. But anyway, Eyal sort of sacrifices himself so Annie can get away. He pops in one of these sort of little mini rice-sized tracer beacons, and later Annie goes to try and find him, and of course someone has found the tracer beacon, this little rice-sized thing, and slapped it to a cell phone to get in touch with Annie, know that they have Eyal, and it almost seems a little too neat and clean in my opinion. I almost wonder, as I look back through these last few episodes, if Eyal still isn't setting her up. I really have that strong feeling about that, but Annie seems very competent, and I wonder if she's not thinking the same thing at this point. So overall, I thought this was a really good episode. Annie Strong gets by reasonably well on her own, with the exception of the travel directions, and I enjoy it. Now, as far as some of the subplots go, she called Joan to get some help, and Joan was willing to do that, so maybe their rift isn't quite as severe as we've assumed it is. And then secondly, we had what really is virtually totally unrelated was this Augie's trip back to Iraq with his battle buddy to help rehabilitate a wounded service veteran who hasn't quite been able to get over his wartime experience. This episode did come out around Veterans Day, so I imagine that's part of what it's timed, and there's absolutely no problem with paying respect to either, you know, the people who have fought for this country or have been wounded for this country. And I tried to take it in that aspect, and as if you want to encapsulate it all by itself, or perhaps if this was a little mini web episode, it was nice and cute, and I guess it shows a little bit of Augie's sort of development and acceptance of what happened to him and how that he's, you know, comfortable with that. So looking at it that way, I thought it was nice, but it did nothing at all to advance any storyline. Oh, and I almost forgot the best part. They finally had their bar meeting, and you know what happened? Absolutely nothing. We waited for this for like 4 or 5 episodes. Oh, I can't wait to see you. We got to go to the bar. We have to talk at the bar. And we get there, and nobody's got anything to say. There's no lip locking. There's no ripping of clothes off that we were expecting.
Augie chickened out.
Chickened out, yeah, come on. I'm a little more forgetting of the subplot with Augie because I know from being on Twitter and everything else that certainly Christopher Gorham and other members of the cast were really just over the moon for having this opportunity to show that side of helping the veterans and helping our service people that are going through some of the psychological issues that come with being in country and then trying to come back to the real world and dealing with what they went through over there. And I really like the fact that, you know, they did it in a way that while it was very pro service, it wasn't one of those types of things that you occasionally get on shows like Stargate or NCIS, where it's like rah-rah military is awesome type of thing. It was more of just a, this is the way it goes, but this is something that we should be doing for the people that are fighting for our country and volunteering to go through this very difficult situation. So I really enjoyed it on the level of knowing that the people involved were really very into what they were doing, that it wasn't just a plot line. It was something that they were invested in personally.
Oh, no. I mean, I took it as that. Like I said, it didn't do anything to advance the actual plot line, but it was a nice story in and of itself, encapsulated, yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it did advance it in terms of, you know, the Augie not being there, you know, meaning that she was more on her own. I also did like them bringing those issues up. I mean, it's not directly affecting the plot, but it is giving us more, you know, I'm just showing you more of Augie's background, but, you know, but I think, you know, we were definitely seeing him, you know, actually, you know, it was helping him come to terms, you know, I mean, after they'd gone through that, you know, the whole, you know, sort of the therapy, non-therapy little, you know, little arc of, you know, no, this showing, you know, that no, I mean, there are issues that he's still dealing with, and, you know, I think this did actually help him acknowledge them more than he has been, so... You know, as far as character development, I thought it was a good thing to do. And still had the effect of, you know, having some having some impact on the plot. You know, through his absence anyway.
Mm. And I still think that this is probably the best we've ever seen Eyal as a character. Even if his sacrifice play has been very telegraphed, because we've kind of seen this coming, and I hope that they do have more to it than just the fact that he's going to end up taking one for the team, and that's going to be how he exits the show. I still like it, even if that's what it turns out to be, because it feels like a natural thing for him to do as penance for the things that he's done for Mossad, and now that he's kind of on his own, he gets the chance to do what he's really felt like he should do to support Annie, because, you know, he's been there for her for a certain extent. Maybe it was a mixture of his personal feelings as well as his duty to do so, but I just thought that it was very natural for things to go the way that they did, and I like the fact that they've taken the time to build this whole thing with Ansari, and this whole mission has been a much stronger final arc of the season than we had in the second season, where it was just, it was basically, let's dial back Annie into being a complete idiot again, just because we need to have something to do for the end of the season. This felt a lot more natural.
Yeah. And I also wanted to comment, I mean, to my mind, I mean, yes, I mean, it was Annie, you know, that whole thing of Annie's reaction to the girlfriend getting shot. I mean, I actually applauded a bit inside because to my mind, that was them, finally acknowledging, no, she is becoming a hardened agent, and this is what you have to do if this is what you're dealing with, day in and day out for months and years. You cannot get too attached, and that felt like a really good reality check finally.
Well, but even Eyal coming along and saying basically, don't lose it completely. You want to still have that empathy. You just don't want it to rule your every action. You have to apply it according to the situation. And I like the fact that there was that moderation. If nothing else, we're seeing Annie as a character grow, which is something that we complained about before, that it wasn't happening. And now we are seeing it happening. I think that it definitely is bringing this season to a very logical and appreciative close. I mean, we can say at this point that the writers have learned a few lessons along the way. Maybe not as many as we'd like, but you take everything that you can get.
Oh, sure. And even, I mean, just a minor point, when Gary's mentioning about the parking lot scene, I actually liked that, she got out of it basically, she was doing as well as she could, but that it was just the happenstance of the other car pulling out and blocking them, that she was able to get away, that didn't turn into, James Bond style, car reversing, magic basically for her to get out of there, that, it was, she was getting a little lucky.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's just, she's got to rely on luck quite often, and so do most agents if in that kind of situation, I imagine.
Exactly.
So, all right, well, what would you give this one, Edmund?
I would give it an 8,
I think.
Yes.
That's what I gave it, so I certainly agree. And Gary, how about you?
I'm giving it a 9. I thought it was a really good episode. It kept me on the edge of my seat throughout it, and it had some surprises I wasn't expecting, and I really enjoyed it.
Yeah, and that would actually push it right up to the highest scored episode of the season so far, and it being the penultimate episode, that's giving us a lot of good feeling going into the finale, I think.
Absolutely.
All right, well, we started off a little bit low. We went pretty high with this one, and, why don't we go ahead and seesaw again, and we're going to go into Revolution, and here's the promo.
For 15 years, they've lived in darkness. But how did it really all begin?
My partners and I, we set out to invent a device.
And who's responsible?
The pendant. They want to use it as a weapon.
Monday.
That kind of power? We're talking about millions of lives.
The truth.
What are you not telling me?
Will be revealed.
Yeah, I know, telegraphing our commentary, but if you've been going along so far, you know how we feel about this show up to this point. Bronson, why don't you go ahead and give us this recap, if you don't mind.
Okie dokie. Revolution, Season 1, Episode 7, The Children's Crusade. The gang stumble across a group of kids fending for themselves, and Rachel reveals the real reason she deserted her family. That is the right one, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yep. Good. I'm sorry, they're all blurring together. So this was more of the same. I still find the A-plots incredibly boring and tedious. And back in episode 5, I think they just ditched a completely legitimately great excuse to ditch out on the terrible MacGuffin of the show, which is, we have to rescue Danny. And the reason it's a terrible MacGuffin is because they keep botching the genuine attempts to rescue Danny, and because we don't like him as a character. He's annoying. He's whiny. He's like Scrappy-Doo. He's like Wesley Crusher, except not as intelligent. I'm being harsh, but he's just not a boring character. He's not an interesting character. I find him very boring and easy to dislike, and therefore a weak hook for the main plot of the show. And then to make it worse, every week they seem to get caught up in some other mess, and it splits the tone of the show between we're going to do the ride into town and fix the problems, and ride out again every week sort of anthology format with the an overarching plot that they really should be devoting all their time to, so it's annoying. There were some upsides in this episode. They took a much better... If they're still on this kick of trying to toughen up Charlie and make her a more legitimate protagonist, then I think they did much better this week than they did last week by having her, you know, get punched in the face a few times and sort of have to be sort of genuinely tough and have to, you know, show a bit of intelligence and kind of knuckle through a bad situation. It was not so bad. The problem was that I spent about half the episode bugged to absolute hell trying to figure out why the captain of the guy in charge of these recruits looked so familiar. And it bugged me, and it bugged me, and it bugged me, and then eventually I had to go look it up on IMDb, and from the fact that you're laughing, Gary, I'm guessing that you did likewise.
No, I recognized him right off the bat. I knew exactly who he was.
Good man.
Even without the white shirt, I recognized him, yes.
It was a good turn from him. I'll give him credit. He was genuinely tough. But yeah, the militia. I'm still and the Republic. It's they keep trying to portray them as cartoonishly bad. To counteract the fact that if you were to sort of take a step back for a tick, they're a much more interesting protagonist. Mm-hmm. If this whole concept's yeah, and then at the last you had the stuff with the lighthouse. And this pendant is just becoming more and more of the One Ring with every episode. Yeah. It's just going to act up of its own accord at the worst possible time and try and get you caught.
I actually like the idea of it being the One Ring, if only because that would actually start making a little bit more interesting. But you know. For the benefit of the audience, because they may not actually know who you're talking about, so who was the charge of the recruiting thing? Just to
the actor, I believe is, I believe the actor's name is Joshua Cox. Am I getting that right?
Yes, yeah.
Gary.
Okay. Yes, you
okay.
Are.
Yes, and we're all chuckling because we recognize him as Corwin from Babylon 5.
There you go. Yeah. I don't know how many people would even know when they looked it up.
And we'd give his rank, except we can't remember what it was at the end of the show.
Changed a few times.
He was, so yeah. He was.
I thought it was Lieutenant.
Colin. That's yeah.
Lieutenant rings a bell.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, but I was just thinking when you mentioned it, it's like, yeah, we probably can just read between the lines, but if there's someone in the audience that doesn't know Babylon 5, it's going to be a little tough. So anyway, yeah, you know, I'm still to the point where at this, you know, we're this many episodes in, I'm still waiting for Charlie to actually be consistently tough or not. You know, pick one, because certainly the writers haven't yet. We kind of need for them to pick one, because it's annoying how she'll start off, you know, one situation being kind of weak, and then they'll decide, nope, she's going to be tough as nails and willing to do whatever is necessary, and then 5 minutes later she decides, oh yeah, no, I'm going to go back to being tough again, and back and forth, and yeah, you can kind of see where I'm going with this.
And if you're not going to be if you're not going to be a sort of tough, capable member of the, like, you know, protagonist of this, you know, adventuring group, you need to be able to bring something else to the table.
Yeah.
And what I feel like between carrying the pendant and being probably the single most intelligent member of the party, although it doesn't necessarily express itself in practical ways a lot, is I think Aaron kind of stepped up in the episode before, and. Yet Charlie keeps failing to do so. She's not a particularly, you know, tough, heroic character, and yet she's not much. She hasn't been good for much else.
Mm-hmm. And yet the whole story is supposed to be her story of coming to terms with finding herself in this whole thing, and mm-hmm. I've yet to see it. So
yeah. Put it this way: Frodo could take her in a fight.
Yeah.
Yeah.
To you.
Yeah, he's a pacifist.
And it is just really odd, though. I mean, the way, you know, sort of from, you know, the early episodes, I mean, cause it's, you know, it sort of seemed like, you know, that scene early on. I mean, that was in, what, second episode, I think, when, you know, she does the whole, you know, Derringer in the sleeve and takes out the guy. And so, you know, so you sort of got the sense of, you know, oh, okay, so, you know, now she's got Uncle Miles around. He's going to, you know, teach her to be a badass. And instead, it's just been, as John said, just this complete wishy-washy, you know, tough 1 minute, and then, you know, bleeding about things the next. So it's,
one step forward, two steps back.
Well, yeah. You know, they keep setting her up in situations that I shouldn't say that I'm looking forward to something bad happen to her, but you think she's going to go through some cathartic event. You know, first, the last episode where she was potentially going to, you know, either be raped or have to kill this good guy, supposedly. And then, you know, then it sort of, you know, fails out. Now this time she's taken aboard this, like, training ship, and of course it's, let's hit her in the face again. I sort of don't like that this ongoing thing about beating her all the time, but anyway, it's there, and so you think that something, you know, serious is going to happen that's going to cause some change in her or some realization or some difference, and it constantly turns to almost the best possible outcome for her. And I'm waiting for something to go bad, go wrong, where she, you know, she gets that sort of wake-up call, I guess, and she hasn't gotten it, and they keep setting them up and taking them away from us.
The problem is the best one they've had, they've tried to do that about half a dozen times, and the best one in the show so far was in the second episode, where it ended on this note of her stepping up, and she shoots this guy in the face to get his sniper rifle with a gun thing, and it was, she stepped up and did it, and you could tell, like, she didn't like it, and she's clearly not as okay with doing it as Miles is, but she's willing to if it means sort of saving someone else. And there was that episode too, also had this moment where Miles was like, that's a different attitude to what I normally encounter, and I kind of respect that. I was like, that's the best version of that they've done in the show so far. Everyone since has not only been worse, but it's completely failed to capitalize on what they've been doing before. There's just such a disconnect. There's such a lack of progress.
Yeah, even as they seem to have a direction slowly but surely with what they want to do with these pendants and stuff, it just feels like the show, the characterization is aimless at any rate.
Yeah.
Which is not something that you want people to feel when they're watching your show.
No.
At least
as far as and I know we've been kind of focusing on the present day, or I guess as defined by the show stuff, but I mean the other thing that was almost like a disconnect was then the flashbacks to the beginning of the tech and the pendants, where, you know, I almost felt like we were, you know, switching shows and going back to flash forward land. But, you know, as we discovered,
the exposition for the sake of exposition.
Yeah,
because that was all it was. There was no natural reason for them to start explaining what was going on with the pendants at that point.
Yeah,
it was just dropped in, maybe because there was no better time to do it, and they kind of need to do it. They know they need to do it. So
You know, and also, you know, well, Grace was kidnapped a while ago, and we haven't gotten back to her. So okay, here's the background on that finally. And oh, look, we got Colin Fiore to come in and play a baddie.
Well, that's new.
Yeah, I'm surprised they even know how many pendants there are. You know, as we open the scene, Charlie's father was barely able to get the, I guess, software or instructions downloaded to the pendant before the power went out. Mm-hmm. And this is supposed to be a guy who's virtually running the company, who is running the company, and he can barely get it done in time. I'm a little surprised she knows there are 12.
Well, you know, okay, so the big revelation that we have at this point is that they came up with some kind of reverse power thing.
They were trying to make clean energy and failed so miserably they actually turned off the power.
Well, they found out a way, which is great. And then all too predictably, the government says, hey, this would make a great weapon. And basically...
And for the umpteenth time, it's like Matheson's are doing dumb, dumb things for the sake of saving Danny.
Yes, of course. Because like, that's like the family hobby.
I mean, it's thematic consistency, but...
Yeah, well, okay, let's just cut to the chase then. And
maybe Ron natural Stone, selection's trying to tell us something.
What would you give this one?
I'd give it a 6.
Okay.
It's tempting to go lower, but there was just the odd point of something interesting happening or a moment that wasn't completely ridiculously dumb.
Okay, Gary, how about you?
I am going to go lower. I am going to go down to a 5. This was a really poor episode. This was a bad episode. If this show should actually make it like seasons down, this is going to be one of the 5 worst episodes that they'll record. It was
The last episode was worse.
Well, I said one of the 5, but yeah. this was
one of the 7 so far.
Oh, okay.
Well, come on. At least last episode had her in a dress where you could get a little bit of fan service out of it, but
this is bad following on poor, so it's down to a 5. I think to give more than that is being too generous. This was a poorly written episode, poorly acted episode. No one was really given a chance to shine at all. It was just horrible. The only, like you said, the slight tech reveal about the blackout tech was not enough to save this episode above a 5, in my opinion.
Edmund, how about you?
Oh, I'm with Gary. I'm a solid 5.
Yeah, I got to say that I felt the same way. It just, we were joking before that, as I was watching this episode, I was waiting for the kids to break out into the theme song from Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome. Because it was just as jarring as that to have just a bunch of kids and having to, have this Miles and the group come in and save the kids and whatever. It just was not a very good episode, in my opinion. And through 7 episodes, I gotta say, we are looking at a show that is barely trying to hang on to below average right now.
Yeah. But it's still
Ladies
getting
and
good
gentlemen,
ratings,
we have the new
it?
Event.
But yeah,
it's getting good numbers, though, isn't it? Reasonable numbers?
It is getting fantastic numbers.
Yeah,
actually.
I think it has started to drop a little bit.
How could
bit.
It not? Yeah.
Yeah. And of course, just because it worked so well for Heroes in the Event, they're about to do their take it off for
8 months or whatever. Yeah. Sure.
Wait, for how many months? I don't know. Not enough.
2 to 3 months, I believe. It will come back in March, but I'm not quite sure exactly when it is.
That will kill this show.
Of course it will.
Yes! Brilliant! Fantastic!
No, but
kill
honestly,
it with fire!
What are these network people thinking to take off a new show for that many months right in the middle of this? They have to realize that it's just going to kill the show.
No, you got to remember that network people are convinced that long hiatuses have nothing to do with ratings going down, because they always cite the fact that, oh, the first one back was not appreciably different than the last one that we aired. Yes, because everybody comes back just to see if it got any better. And when it doesn't, the ratings just plummet. They don't have a clue. All right, well, we're going to move on to what I think is a much better show.
That's not hard.
Once again, we're kind of going back and forth. It's a seesaw type of episode. And that would be Arrow, and here's the promo.
Crime happens in this city every day.
Everybody move!
When people are in trouble, they tend to make the wrong choices.
How poetic.
They stole from this city.
Now what?
We take them down.
Okay, and it's Season 1, Episode 6, Legacies. When an off-duty officer is wounded by bank robbers calling themselves the Royal Flush Gang, Diggle tries to convince Oliver that he must do more than go after the men on his father's revenge list. Meanwhile, Tommy asks Thea for dating advice, and Moira demands to know why Oliver keeps disappearing. All right, well, we just got done with basically Oliver taking a couple episodes to put his plan to protect his secret identity.
Shore up his alibi.
Absolutely. Yeah. And so that piece of the puzzle has been taken care of. So it makes sense that they would start laying the foundation for why he goes beyond his little revenge mission and turns into more of a hero. And who's going to do that than the person that he keeps trying to make a sidekick and keeps telling him, no, we're partners, or I'm basically going to leave you to your own devices and see how long you last.
Yes.
Which I love the fact that he's got that conscience right there in front of him constantly to keep him kind of grounded. And, they still manage to keep this mission of, not connected to his father's list, this side mission to, stop crime. They still manage to connect it to his family.
Yes.
So it wasn't too far from the reservation, but it still was growth for the character. And it, all I could think of was, man, I wish they could have done stuff like this on Smallville. You know, we're six episodes in, and let's take this as a contrast to what we've been talking about with Revolution.
Arrow to Smallville is like Christopher Nolan to Joel Schumacher at this point.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
It's just like some people have come along and just said, you know what? There's a way to do this that will make it A, not suck, but B, also be smart. And if you just, it's a thing of like, just if you be intelligent about the way you're doing things and assume that the viewers have a shred of intelligence as well, you're going to engage people. They're going to be more interested, and with any luck, they'll rise to meet the show, for lack of a better term. Like they will invest more, and they will then start looking for things of equal intelligence. And what do you know? It's a whole proliferation thing.
And then Alphas gets renewed, which would be a nice touch. But we're not talking about that show right now. But I love the fact that Ace turned out to be, you know, the son of someone who's, you know, Oliver's father had basically laid off as part of his, you know, underhanded business practices back in the day. And so as Oliver's father is trying to get him to, you know, make amends for his past mistakes, you've got the, you know, Ace basically doing what he's doing in order to try to live up to his father's, you know, expectations for him. So both of them are on a mission to fulfill what their fathers want. And so there's that rapport that they've got. And I just really kind of like the fact that at the end of the day, they're both going above the law or beyond the law in order to try to be what their parents wanted them to be. And it kind of gives Oliver somebody else to look at and compare himself to give him a more of a reality check. And, you know, we're talking about, you know, a show about Green Arrow that, and again, six episodes in, we're seeing more layering and more character work than we've seen from any episode of Revolution. And it still boggles my mind that we can sit back after just a couple months and say that Arrow is just far and above what Revolution, the show that everybody was talking about, is producing. Yeah. But yeah, this show just, especially on that end of things, is really surprising me. And then you've got, on top of that, the things that you would think would actually weaken the show, the relationship issues. But every single relationship is laced with all of the context of what happened with Oliver before, during, and after the incident on the yacht. So
this is the relation. This side plot is the perfect thing to point to as to why Arrow is so far an extraordinarily creatively successful show, because it can do a side plot that's not about Green Arrow kicking butt. I mean, Green Arrow kicking butt, you know, I love the A-plot, but, as you know, we've been watching that for a few episodes now. This is something different. This is about the relationships of other characters and how they're interacting and dealing with other. And I'm finding it just as compelling.
Mm-hmm.
Like, this could be so melodramatic. And on Smallville, this would be... The first act, the entire first act of the episode and the entire last act of the episode would just be all this stuff, and it would be melodramatic as all get out. And yet here it feels, it works. I'm digging it. I'm getting more into the characters and into how they interact, and I'm wondering what's going to happen next. And it's working for me.
It helps that they're adults. For the
most
part,
that's definitely a plus.
Yeah. I mean, Thea is obviously the brat, but right. You also get the sense of just how damaged she is because of Oliver being away for 5 years and having to deal with the toxic relationship of who was left.
Yes.
I mean, clearly her mother is trying to deal with I still refer to him as Captain Jack because he doesn't have a name on the show, but John Barrowman's character.
He is the well-dressed man.
Whatever, yes. He's Captain.
It's
Jack.
Like it's like Arrow's version of HRG.
Yes, but whatever the case may be, he the sense I get is that he was the one that Oliver's father was in cahoots with, and it was, you know, his desire to kind of get away from those underhanded and illegal practices that led to him being killed off. And if Oliver hadn't been on the yacht, no one would have known that, because Oliver, as they keep saying, wasn't supposed to be there.
Right.
So, you know, that gave his father the opportunity to pass on that legacy that otherwise he would not have had a chance to do. So it's all fitting together, and I think finally we're getting a little bit of a sense of that, and that was one of those pieces that was kind of out there, and it wasn't satisfying me very well, but I'm really starting to dig that now as well. But I feel like Tommy, you know, the guy who's basically just trying to be this, you know, they're writing as if he's supposed to just be this obstacle between Oliver and Laurel. I'm thinking that he's going to wind up being someone very important as a villain down the road. I think he's tied in with everything that's going on a lot mm-hmm. more than he seems to be. Like, he's either working for Captain Jack or the well-dressed man or whatever or what, but I have a sense he's going to wind up being a henchman that, you know, when he finally shows up in all of his glory, we're going to be like, oh, wait, he's him.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense, and you know, also, I mean, I especially like that, given you know how well they've been building that relationship, you know, mm-hmm. where it's, you know, no, I mean, you know, throughout this episode, where you know, this could easily have been, you know, yeah, just the rich guy trying to impress the girl, and you know, instead they bring it around to, you know, no, where you know, no, it really did work for him by the end, just because you know he wasn't being a tool like the other guy, and was, you know, actually being a real person. You know, so yeah, I mean that, you know, I definitely like that idea of them, you know, building him up this way and then turning him.
Mm-hmm. And also I think that would turn out to be one other reason for Laurel to take up the mantle of Black Canary eventually.
Yeah.
Which, God, as good as Katie Cassidy has been on this show, they need to get her in that role sooner rather than later, because she already kicks ass.
You said role, but I know you meant fishnets.
Yes.
Yep. Come on. Like, you're not thinking it, too.
Sam, now.
But no, come on. She's already come in and kicked ass and taken names, and she's got just this constant competence underneath of everything. She's tough as nails. She knows what she's doing. And I want to kind of see her get out there and just be just as active as Oliver is. I mean,
I'm right with you on that point. The actress has really impressed me in this role. I wasn't one of the fans of Supernatural in the early seasons who was jumped on this Katie Cassidy bandwagon, because I don't think the bandwagon formed until people decided they didn't like her predecessor, the actress who came after her. So her being in Arrow was never exactly a big draw for me, but she has definitely impressed the heck out of me in this show, and I'm looking forward to not just her being Black Canary, but the evolution, the growth that the character will have to go through to get to that point, because they're layering the foundations of that, and it's just. Yeah. If you had told me 6 months ago that Arrow would be a show I was really psyched about, I would have knocked you upside the head.
Oh, well, just look at what they're doing with Oliver. I mean, because we're talking about they're putting the foundation down for Black Canary, and I could almost say that this show could be her origin show, and it would be just as meaningful and good, just on that level. But you've got Oliver's stuff, which they've done this smart move of they're going to show you his origins on the island where he learned all this stuff at the exact same time that they're showing his origins as a hero in, you know, Starling City. So you've got this parallel going on, but at the same time, they're telling two distinct stories about the same character.
Oh yeah. It's
brilliant stuff. I mean, it's really well done.
They get how a flashback structured story is supposed to work.
Yeah.
And especially in the last 10 years. And I mean, Lost was a huge influence on it becoming a big thing in mainstream television. But so few shows have actually got it right. Revolution is not nailing it.
No.
But Arrow is doing it well. Is that it's about telling? It's about you have the difference between a plot and a story. The plot is the things that happen, and the story is how you frame it. And you start a story at the inciting incident, the thing that kicks off into the main body of the story, and that is Oliver returning to Starling City. Everything before that is prologue. We need it. We need to see how he makes that journey. but we can't just watch that journey for however long it takes and then start on the thing. So it's being blended together. That's just basic and smart, and it's that's what it's for. That's how you're supposed to use it.
Yeah, but how many other shows would just go ahead and have one flashback episode, that mm-hmm. special episode to give you the background on the island, and then never and then just refer to it from then on and just say, oh, but now you get the sense that he was this guy before, that everyone says he was the spoiled rich guy who took nothing seriously, and oh yeah, he was on the island, we showed you your little special flashback episode, and now you understand why he's this this kind of conflicted badass now. No, they're actually showing you this long journey that he took. And they're also telling you that the guy that you saw at the in the pilot that took up this mantle of this vigilante is not the final step of the process of growth. Yeah. It's just a transitionary moment. He still has a long way to go. So you're seeing the beginning part of that journey, and you're seeing from the middle onward. So yeah, they're just using the framing device and the flashbacks all as one way of telling a much larger character study. And, you know, again, at the end of this episode, they make it very clear, this is not a warm and fuzzy guy.
Yeah.
He will kill people. That, you know, there's a reason why the cops want him off the streets.
Yeah.
So it's a really good superhero show, but it's a good character study. I really like the fact that they are taking the foundational stuff from the comics, and they're really just doing Nolanizing it. Next episode is
that's gonna be a term now.
Yeah,
Nolanizing stuff.
Well, the next episode I think is co-written by Jeff Johns, which is a point of interest at this point. Not to reuse the word point too often, but anyway, speaking of points and therefore scores, I gave this one an 8. The show has been consistently good for the last few episodes, above average in my book, and I just can't find any reason to dial back from that. What do you think, Edmund?
Yeah, I would give it an 8 as well, and just one quick last point. I really like them finally revealing that, yes, it was Invisible Ink in the book, which is what I suspected from the look of it in the beginning.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
You know, but also the point that it brings up that, you know, yeah, so he found this list, and so far as we can tell, I mean, it was just a list. You know, and I'm interested to see if they start playing with the fact of, you know, okay, you know, this is how much of this is his interpretation of what that list actually means.
Oh, sure. When is he going to find out that because he was so bent on revenge,
mm-hmm.
he didn't take a step back and think about what those people were on the list, why they were on there, and what they might know?
Exactly.
Yep.
So and not to mention what's on those pages that he ripped out and.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's the other wonderful thing is that because we see all these details now, we can see what his regrets might be down mm-hmm. the road and how hard he makes it for himself because he wasn't thinking ahead, you know.
Yeah.
But anyway, Bronstum, what would you give this one?
I'd also give it an 8. You said a few moments ago that Arrow is a really good superhero story and a really good character drama, and I think that good superhero stories are good character dramas. Like, it's just when they're done right, the two are just entwined, because I personally am a big fan of superheroes as a genre, style, whatever, because I think, you know, looking at one of the classics of the genre, Watchmen, is just a big thing about how you have to be really weird and a bit screwed in the head to kind of to go into that sort of thing. And Arrow is just absolutely living up to the potential and the promise of what good superhero stories can be.
Well, yeah, I mean, you actually bring up a really good point, because the thing about Watchmen was, if you take away someone like Dr. Manhattan, pretty much everybody else in Watchmen is just a normal person that has taken up a vigilante lifestyle.
But yeah, a vaguely, in some form or another, kind of vaguely psychopathic, or in some cases really psychopathic, who has chosen this as their outlet.
Right, and so, I mean, you know, you can almost say
you need
that
to be weird. But even Dr. Manhattan is just like, I mean, the reason why I think Smallville, as much as we bag on it, it had its moments where it got to be, where it was pretty damn, it had its moments where it was pretty damn good, and those moments were where it really capitalized on the fact that being Superman's, like, not an easy gig. I don't know, I think the best Superman stories and the best Batman stories and the best, you know, Green Arrow stories and things like Watchmen and whatnot. They work because they seize on just how strange and interesting and to a point damaged a person you would have to be to become a superhero, and then what happens when you mix them up with other people.
Absolutely, but you know, the other point I was going to make on top of that, though, is that they're human beings, right? Batman is just a normal, well, not normal, but a human being that trains to be a vigilante. And what we've got here is also we have yet to see anybody that is not just a person taking on a persona. Arrow does not have superpowers. He's a guy who learned skills because he had to survive for 5 years on a seriously messed up island. Maybe not the one from Lost, but not too far removed. And then you've got, you know, the villains so far, none of them have been exceptional in some weird superpower way. They've been specialized individuals like Deadshot or something like that, but they haven't had, quote, superpowers. And I like the fact that they are grounding this at least somewhat in the, quote, real world. You know, yes, it's still stylized and it's a comic book world, but it's not that far from ours. You could kind of see stuff like this happening if people really decided they were going to go that nutty.
Mm-hmm.
So it's got that going for it. You know, it hasn't strayed into, you know, where Alphas is. Well, where Alphas is a really good show, but it's clearly a comic book superpower show at this point. This is more of the Batman thing where, you know, no one in Batman really had superpowers in the three movies that Nolan put together. It was very grounded, and it's definitely taken that approach. Thank you, gentlemen, for all your help for this episode. And definitely, if you want to give us some comments, you can follow us on Twitter at Critical Myth, or you can go and like our page on Facebook. Again, that's Critical Myth.
You can give us feedback by visiting the website over at www.criticalmyth.com. Just check out the entries for the show and leave us a comment. If you can't find it, just go all the way up to the top of the page. There's a link there, and there is also a drop-down box for all of the shows we talk about. So please let us know what you think.
Or you can go over to the VOG Network page and go over to the forums, and we have a dedicated forum for this show. You can leave comments there for us.
You can also email your feedback to feedback@criticalmyth.com, or you can leave us a review on iTunes.
Or you can call our Google voicemail line at 908-977-MYTH. That's 908-977-6984.
And don't forget that Critical misuse of any and all copyright material is only intended for parody, news analysis, critique, or for educational purposes, as provided within United States Code Title 17, also known as the Fair Use Act. Please don't sue us.
And the comments and opinions of the Critical Myth podcasters and reviewers are not necessarily those of its distributors, partners, or affiliates. But let's face it, we're probably right anyway. So until next time.
Battle buddy, you haven't said more than 2 words this entire trip.
Fine, man.
Strike that. 5 words.
Present. Armed.
You know, it hasn't changed a bit. The smell. Sweat and sand.
Gas fumes.
Baghdad perfume.
Soldiers, you are officially back in theater. The fact that you're wearing the uniform again should tell you that. We move as a team, and we are responsible for the men on our left and our right. Warriors, welcome back.
Hey, Downey. Lieutenant Wade's giving an in-progress debrief on Operation New Dawn in the Ohio tent, 1700 hours. You want to hit it?
I'm good.
All right. How about getting invited to the mess hall? They're doing a great pot roast.
I'm just whipped. All right. I'm going to crash early tonight.